down crooked paths once more. Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Melvin Sparks, The Clash, and Sharon Van Etten. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Earth Day is around the corner. Celebrate with KBOO at our Earth Day tree planting open house, April 22nd, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mingle with other earth-conscious radio heads, enjoy snacks and drinks, and become a part of KBOO's roots. That's April 22nd, 11 a.m. at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, for KBOO's Earth Day Tree Planting Open House.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and the nonprofit Oregon Potters Association, presenting its annual event, the Ceramic Showcase, with the Gathering of the Guilds, April 24th through 26th at the Oregon Convention Center. More info is available at CeramicShowcase.com.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Hand him on now, whoa, 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 whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver stream. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Julia Dolan. She's the Minor White Senior Curator of Photography and the Interim Chief Curator at the Portland Art Museum. Julia is talking about David Hockney works from the collections of Jordan D. Schnitzer and his family foundation, a show which is on now through July 26th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Julia.
Thanks so much, Joseph.
So you're the photography person at the Portland Art Museum, but you have this incredible, you're sort of in charge of this show of David Hockney's work, and everyone kind of knows him as the painter who then investigated photography. He's 88 now, and you know, if you saw his early work, it was etchings. He was a draftsman as a teenager. He went to the Royal College of Art in London. People thought of him as a pop artist, but he ran away to Los Angeles and discovered painting. And then his career changed as he investigated sort of the tools of creating art. And that included making photocollages and then later using iPad for drawing. And he just had a very, very long, interesting career. Just give us a little background on David Hockney and where he stands in the world of contemporary art today.
Happy to. And I think what's been really wonderful for me is stepping in from a little bit of the outside in terms of my own knowledge of David Hockney. I've known him primarily through the photographic works that he has done and the ways in which he uses photography and has been using photography since the 1960s. Even though most of us come to him as a painter, but... I think this exhibition, first of all, it offers something for everyone because the range of subject matter that he has covered over his going on seven decades in art making, there is something for everyone to see and connect to. But I think it's also a really important moment to demonstrate that he is very democratic in the way that he approaches a medium. And he's not interested in only painting, although his paintings are magnificent and important to the history of art. And we love to see them in person. He has been making prints since the early 1950s, 1954, he was maybe 16 or 17 years old. It has always been part of his practice. And it's wonderful to see him change the way he looks at the world, think about art making and processes and experimenting alongside the painting work that he has done. And I think another really important point about his making prints is that when he was a young artist, he's from Bradford, England, so he's from a textile town, you know, working class family, not a lot of money. He is deeply interested in the arts from about 3 or 4 years old. He sees this as his path almost from the beginning. He is first going to art school in Bradford, and then he goes to art school in London, and it's very expensive. It's post-World War II. It's not a country that's recovering like the United States did, of course.
It was miserable.
It was miserable. Yeah, much closer to Europe.
Rationing was still in memory. Yeah.
Yeah, not a lot of money, you know, for upkeep or progress necessarily. So he's pretty poor when he's living and trying to survive in London in art school. And printmaking is one of the ways that he can actually pay for what he does.
Oh.
And what he learned at the Royal College of Art is that he loved painting, but he needed a lot of paint. He made big paintings. The canvas was expensive. The paint was expensive. He had to buy all of that. And he very quickly learned that the printing department at the school would supply plates and ink, and I think maybe even paper for free.
Right.
So this was a way for him to work through ideas, experiment with other processes. And also he was becoming very popular very early while he was even in art school. So he was able to start selling the prints more rapidly, which helped him get his name out into the world. He won printmaking contests. Gallerists were starting to see his work, not only through his painting, but his prints. And it helped support him as he was making his way through art school.
So printing things on photographic paper was just an extension of that. Oh, this is a, you know, I'm not tied to paint. I can I can do whatever I want. So he, you know, in the 60s, he kind of discovered Los Angeles pretty early in the 60s and loved it because, you know, it was sunshine and swimming pools and, you know, you could be openly gay, which you couldn't be particularly in Britain. It was still illegal. So he was known for these paintings of celebrities, people he knew, and then he would take these, make these paintings of pools, swimming pools, like naked guys swimming in pools, and he was fascinated by the patterns of the light, the diffraction and the shadows on the pool. You have a piece which is actually a poster for the LA Olympics. And it's a grid of 12 squares, and it's a body kind of upside down, you know, someone swimming underwater, and the blues are very, blues and whites, you know, characterize the rippling pool. When he's at this point in his career, you know, he's doing commercial work, obviously getting paid quite well to do an Olympics poster. Was he considered a commercial artist at this point?
No, I don't think so. But again, he's somebody who he doesn't have boundaries like that, which I really love. There's a wonderful biography written about him. It was written, I believe, in the 90s, and it's called A Rake's Progress, which is based off of a series of prints that he did, which is based off of a very important series of prints that were done in England a couple of centuries ago. And what I loved about this biography is it really expresses and embodies the fact that Hockney is somebody who doesn't see the world as having boundaries, which I do. I experience that the world through that lens of, oh, I can't do this, but I can do that. And that's not who David Hockney is. And so mm-hmm. not only is he almost perplexed, I think, by people being upset or about queerness or gayness, or to the point of it being illegal in multiple countries, and it still is today, that was perplexing to him because that's who he is and who he was. But he also doesn't see boundaries and strict boundaries in artwork either. So he is expressing himself through whatever tool it takes for him to figure out and employ his ideas. And I'm glad that you brought up the swimming pools. And New York is the first place that Hockney went to. He went to New York first and really, I think, experienced the, oh my gosh, America is open in a different way that I've never experienced. Then he goes to LA and of course falls in love with LA and the light and the sunshine and, you know, the human beings and the more readily available queerness and openness about being gay. But the pools are such an important exercise for him and bodies of water, and you see him still working on that concept today. How do you represent water? How do you do that? It is constantly moving. It is filtering light. It is filtering our understanding of whatever is behind the water. So when you look at a pool, how in the world can you harness a gentle wave on the pool or someone jumping into it? So for decades, he has been wrestling with interpreting that through painting, through prints, and also through photography. He started using photography as a tool for his paintings in the 1960s, and then occasionally treats photographs as works of art unto themselves.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, he painted pools in a very simple way, just like these curves, these crescents. He didn't try and like capture the detail of light. He just did these sort of arcs and little marks, you know. It was kind of childlike approach.
And those are actually in his pool in those photographs too. The pool was drained and he painted those curves. There's some blue and white curves. Those are, so if you're looking at the poster, those are Polaroid prints from his pool in his backyard. And so the pool was painted and then filled with water.
Oh, okay.
And so he's also playing with that. Yeah, but that's okay because that's what he's doing. You're maybe interpreting it in a different way, makes perfect sense, because in his prints and paintings, he's trying to figure out what objects behind water look like and how the water changes what they look like from millisecond to millisecond as the water moves.
Let's look at a picture of his mother. I think his mother visited him in LA and sat for a portrait. It's got that kind of large sliding glass doors, you know, shag carpet. There are books in the background.
And his painting. There's a Picasso painting in the back.
Yeah. and there's like her handbags on the floor. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a bunch of flowers on the floor. I guess this is his apartment. And it seems like the very opposite of Bradford, you know, that you...
Yes.
This wide open spaces. She looks kind of uncomfortable. But the whole picture is built up of snaps. You know, a grid. There must be dozens of them. And then he laid them all out and glued them together onto us. Onto a board, but the edges are uneven. He didn't try and square everything off. He just lets things lay the way the eye might see the room.
Yes. And that is the influence of artists like Picasso and Braque. He was very interested in cubism, and he truly believes and picks apart vision at all times. He truly believes that we do not see in a one-point perspective in the way that most cameras show us the world. He was very interested in demonstrating with a camera that our vision is constantly moving. It doesn't have a perfect frame around it. It's edgy. It's technically blurry, I think, for most of us around our periphery of our vision. But for him, the way that our eyes look around a room or a particular subject, you get that feeling through these 4x6 quick prints that many of us have in photo albums from our childhood or from our parents and our distant relatives.
These are, you'd send your film to the supermarket or the chemist, and they would give you a wallet back the next day.
Yeah. That is exactly what they are. They're like, and you could go to the drive up photo hut in the, this is very true of LA. You could go up to the photo hut, drive up, drop off your film, pick it up an hour later, pick it
oh,
up
really?
A day or two later. Oh yeah, that was very United States. There are these little photo huts. Yeah, and they were just almost like coffee, quick coffee drive
yeah.
are now. But also you could take them inside, you know, to the market. But that was, you know, very culturally normal at the time. And he's using that language of the everyday here in a kind of an everyday photograph, which I love. And he had the understanding, and I can see it in the prints now, these prints aren't, the photographic prints aren't really made to last forever. The chemistry was quick and dirty.
Yeah.
And so you will see photographs from the 70s, 80s, 90s in your own photo albums that are fading and changing. And I can note that in this photograph, but I appreciate the fact that he was fully aware of that. And, you know, we all have lifespans and so do photographs, but mm-hmm. he uses and understands that language within this wonderful angled portrait of his mother, who he was very, very close to.
Yeah, there's this Yosemite, California image, you know, of this big white mountain, but there's an alley of trees leading up to it and a road. So you got this weird, you know, that's what Yosemite's like, right? It's so big, it kind of looms over everything. I think that's El Capitan, right? The cliff face.
Yes.
But this is an iPad painting. So he got into sort of, was it like finger painting at first and then using a stylus?
Yeah. So if you recall, I remember very distinctly when the iPhone came out in 2007, and there was an early app on the iPhone called Brush, and he started using it and even connected with the maker of the app. Oh. And when iPads came out in around 2010, I forget the exact year, he moved from the iPhone to working with an iPad and experimented with all the ways as the technology improved and changed that he could get different line quality with the iPad. So the Yosemite images that we have in the exhibition right now are earlier iPad drawings. And so he was drawing with this app on the iPad. And then really his only boundaries were the size of the paper and how large an object could be made because of the paper. So it's a very, very large print.
Mm-hmm.
The technology allows him to make this image on an iPad and then transfer it over to paper. I will admit that I was a little suspicious of them at first, having only seen them online and maybe in magazines. I didn't know what they were going to be like in person. And I really have come to appreciate them in person. He is someone who has been making prints since the 1950s. He can etch. He knows line quality. So he has experimented, and over time, because we have later iPad drawings, and I think you can see the arc of his understanding of the material, the technology, and how he's become more sophisticated with it. And what I also love about it is you, as a visitor, can make your own iPad drawings mm-hmm. In the exhibition, just a little bit outside of it in the Schnitzer Sculpture Court. So you can figure out how he used his tools, but then express yourself through them. We cannot do that for you, unfortunately, if we wanted to show you how to etch. Etching involves baths of acid.
Yeah.
And it's very dangerous.
Yeah.
It's so dangerous. We can't, the fumes and so on, we can't allow that to happen in the museum because we don't want to make people sick, but we can let you do what he does. Now with the iPad, children and adults making wonderful expressions and drawings of their mm-hmm. own.
My name's Joseph Galibin. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Julia Dolan from the Portland Art Museum. She's talking about David Hockney, works from the collections of Jordan D. Schnitzer and his family foundation. There's a piece which is a photo of a vase of sunflowers.
Yes.
Next to a pic of a drawing or an iPad drawing of the same vase of sunflowers. He sort of propped up the drawing somehow, and it's all framed. It's very meta, you know, you don't quite know what angle you're at. It says sunflowers for Jonathan. Say a little bit what, not only does he include images in the background, you know, like some of the grandmasters would have a picture within a picture. But
Yes.
he's also during the he was also making digital bouquets of flowers and sending them to people during COVID, right? When
He
you couldn't do.
was. Yes. He was doing that, which I think is so wonderful and loving. And we have many examples of them in the exhibition. And he said that, you know, I can make these bouquets for you and send them to you, and they won't die. They will last. And what a touching thing to do when all of us were restricted in terms of our being able to see our friends and loved ones. And there is a through line for me there too, because many of the vases that are incorporated our glass vases, and he is again figuring out how to express what water does. He did that in the pools. He's now doing this in a very small vessel, and you will see the tablecloth or the wall behind. He's trying to interpret, this time on an iPad drawing, how the water bends and refracts and changes the background. But something that is a wonderful part of the exhibition, I think, I didn't curate it personally, I hosted it here. The original curator put this together, is how portraits are so important, demonstrating how portraits are so important to his practice. And he's not only showing faces and bodies of the people he cares about, he's also making portraits of people through objects of them that represent them. So a hat and glasses and a pipe of someone he's friends with. An ashtray, I think, is a self-portrait, right? And so things that are precious to people, he can express his admiration and care for them through object portraits, if you will. And something that he learned really on, which I appreciate very much, is he stopped doing portraits of people he didn't know because he felt that he really couldn't understand and represent them because he didn't know them well enough. And he would talk about having to redo the face and scrape it and redo it and redo it. So he maybe could get the environment and the body of his sitters, but he could not complete their faces unless he knows them well. So all of the portraits that you see of within the exhibition, and there are many, are of people he knows well and cares about and feels close enough to do them justice within their portrait.
There is a self-portrait. He's got his little brown glasses on with the upper rims. His hair is white, but he's colored it blue, you know, for the picture. Blue background, blue jacket, and he's blowing a kiss, but he's looking kind of startled as well at the same time. He's not smiling. Well, can you smile? I guess you could smile with his eyes. Where does the self-portrait sit in his world?
It sits everywhere. He includes himself in many things. And at the beginning of the exhibition, and a pro tip for you, the exhibition begins on the second floor and continues on the first. It can be a little confusing
Yeah, I
sometimes. So
know.
start upstairs and then go downstairs through the elevator or the stairwell inside the exhibition space. Right at the beginning, that we have a timeline of his life, and we start it with a self-portrait that he made in 1954. It's one of his first prints, and it's so wonderful. It's straightforward. He's just kind of holding his arms in a bit of a self-conscious way, but the colors are very vibrant in it. There's some hand painting that goes in it. And remember, he's somebody who's growing up in a textile town, and his mother worked in textiles. And so he's aware of patterning of the carpet, of the wall behind him. And what was so important to me and reminds me of why it's really helpful to see an object in person and not just on a computer screen. I thought that he was wearing a hat. Finally, seeing the object in person, I realized that's not a hat, it's his hair. He had dark hair at the
He had
beginning.
very dark hair. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So this is your reminder to see artworks in person. It's not the same. You pick up on details in person that you can't on a screen.
He was, we'll just have a few minutes. He was, you know, when he would paint the road to Mul, the road to the studio, Mulholland Drive. So these very twisty roads in LA, he would paint these strange pitch, you know, paintings where the mountains are all distorted, but it's his perspective as he moves. He did something similar here in a hotel courtyard in Mexico.
I believe they're lithographs. And what's so interesting is while he was at the hotel, he's not bringing a lithographic stone with him to work on the different qualities. He brought sheets of mylar with him so that he could play with color and overlap as if he was, as if he were using different plates to then make the lithograph or the printed object.
Oh, okay.
So, because how are you going to drag, you know, heavy, heavy stones with you to Mexico when you're on holiday or working, right?
Yeah.
So he's thinking again about how he can reproduce what he's seeing in front of him. But he's very interested, like he is with the images of his mother, in the different views you can be inside, outside. And I find those Mulholland Drive works very poignant because he was losing his hearing in the 1980s. And so he's expressing how, as he's driving, he has opera turned up full blast on his car radio, but he's losing his hearing. So he's thinking about opera, which he adores. Opera's very important to him, as he's driving through this beautiful place that has exposed him to so much many different ways of living.
Yeah.
As he's losing part of his senses, that you know, the sense that is very important to him. So I find them vibrant, but complex and emotional as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Hockney is still active today, as you mentioned at the beginning. He's 88 years old. He's going on 89. He has a new exhibition open in London now. He had a major exhibition at Fondation Louis Vuitton in Paris last year. He is actively painting, making iPad prints. It's his life. One of his art dealers and a good friend of his mentioned to me earlier this year that he gets depressed if he's not making art. Mm-hmm. He is someone who from the age of 3 or 4 knew that art was his being and was what he needed to do. And I think it's so heartwarming to see that someone will not only be true to himself throughout his lifetime, but also be willing to experiment with new ways of working. And I like the fact that because he is at a point in his life now where he's not able to get out as much, he uses a mobility device a lot of the times. He doesn't necessarily sleep all night long. Sometimes that happens to us as we get older. Mm-hmm. The iPad is actually nice for him because he can work with a lit surface, a backlit surface, when it's dark out, when it's maybe the middle of the night. And he also talks about being able to use an iPad in Northeastern England. He has a home that's pretty close to the North Sea. And if anybody's been either on or near the North Sea, you know how moody it is. Mm-hmm. And he loves springtime. He loves the colors of spring. So he can get all of these wonderful colors through the opportunities that he has with the iPad technology. But it also allows him to not have to drag a canvas and paint and all sorts of different brushes out.
Mm-hmm.
And an easel, and then suddenly the winds shift and you get 40 or 50 mile an hour gusts and a massive downpour, and then have to bring all of that quickly back inside. He can use his iPad and be in the space or do a quick sketch and then work on it later inside. So he gets the benefits of technology, but still can express himself in ways that feel true to him.
I've heard him say on video that, I thought everyone in London would be really good at drawing. But when I got there, you know, I realized I was better than a lot of these, most of these Royal College kids, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So drawing has always been in important to him in that sense. And then he had a teacher, one of his works wasn't very good. And his teacher said, well, it's because you're not looking well enough. And he just took that to heart and decided he would look at things more carefully than everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be a constant now. Like you say, he can go out and do plein air art, but everything is set up so he can look for as long as he wants, whether it's dark, whether it's windy.
I think that's a really lovely point. And it's true. He was moving into London at a time when abstraction was being embraced, and he was seeing many of his fellow students mm-hmm. and teachers working in that vein, and he tried it out. But I think that's what's wonderful about having an early and incessant love for artwork and for representing the world through his own hand, that he was very thoughtful about drawing from life, working from the real world, real quote unquote world, and having a real solid basis in the description of the human form of still life and so on and so forth. But that those tools allow you to then broaden. If you have that basis, you can easily broaden and experiment, see what you like, come back to home base whenever you want.
Just tell us, Julia, what you've got going on coming up.
Oh, I'm happy to. So in July, the photography galleries will switch out because photographs, like all of David Hockney's prints, are light sensitive. So we cannot leave them on view as long as paintings. So the first exhibitions that I have on view right now, one is called Together and the other is called A Brief History of Photography, The Landscape. Those have been up since we reopened the museum fully in November, and I will be changing them in July. And I'm going to be doing a series of history of photography from the collection looks in the outer galleries of the photography space. So this next iteration will be A Brief History of Photography, The Portrait. We have some really wonderful photographic portraits, 19th century daguerreotypes all the way up through beautiful inkjet prints from, you know, the past couple of years. And then the larger exhibition is tentatively at this point titled An Honest Day's Work. And they are all going to be photographs from the collection that document and interpret labor. So working, but that doesn't just mean necessarily physical labor, but about parenthood and about the arts and how about making art is also labor. Yeah.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Julia Dolan. She's the Minor White Senior Curator of Photography and also the Interim Chief Curator at the Portland Art Museum. Julia was talking about David Hockney works from the collections of Jordan D. Schnitzer and his family foundation. That show is on at the Portland Art Museum now through July 26th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Julia.
Many thanks to you, Joseph.